Thanks very much, Matt. Thank you for having me here today. It's a real pleasure to be here at Perimeter. It's my first time. And thanks, Matt, for organizing this great workshop. So yeah, I'm going to be telling you about how we can use these amazing quantum technologies we've been hearing about to simulate this fascinating process of false vacuum decay. And I'm going to spend some time unpacking what that is and why that's interesting for cosmologists, and then how we can test it in the laboratory. So this is based on some work I've been doing with a great bunch of people, most of whom are here in the room today. So Jonathan, Matt, Hiranya, Andrew Ponson, who sadly couldn't be here, and Silke. We should have a paper coming out on the archive hopefully very soon. So I wanted to start with some spoilers. Basically, if you can remember three main messages of what I'm going to tell you today, these are the things I'd like you to come away with. So we've been looking at these analog systems for simulating vacuum decay, and we found that we already knew that at the classical level, these could replicate the kind of classical dynamics of these relativistic field theories. But what we found is that by looking at the quantum fluctuations of these systems, these are the same as what you expect for a relativistic field in the early universe as well. So that's kind of nice additional evidence that these analog systems could really tell us something useful for cosmology. We've been playing around with actual experimental parameters to try and come up with a more concrete proposal to give to our experimental colleagues. And we think we have actually found a workable system. And we've been carrying out a bunch of lattice simulations for these parameters and have found that it replicates the kind of behavior that we want to see, which is very exciting. And we've also been thinking about how the presence of thermal noise in the system can affect this decay process and can take you away from the kind of zero temperature limit, which is, I guess, maybe the sort of, the ideal case that you would want to test. And we found that we think with these experimental parameters, you will actually be able to see something very close to the zero temperature decay rate in these analog experiments. So that's very exciting. Okay, so the plan is I'm going to start by talking about what vacuum decay actually is, why you should care about it. I'll come on to talking about how we can simulate this with these quantum analog experiments. And then I'm going to tell you about the theoretical work that we've been doing to try to understand how we can bridge this gap between tabletop experiments and the early universe. Okay, so the basic picture is I have a scalar field. So it's already a bit simpler than the last talk. I don't have to worry about complicated gauge groups and things like that. I just have a scalar field which exists in some kind of potential that looks like this. So it's living initially in a sort of local minimum of the potential, and it wants to get down here to the global minimum of the potential, which I'll call the true vacuum. So it's in this state, which classically is stable, but when you add quantum mechanics into the picture, we know that you can have quantum tunneling processes that make this state then metastable. So the field wants to escape, and the basic question is, how much time does it take for the field to get from here down to here? So because this is an entire field, you can't have the entire field transition all at once, because that would be, you would need to borrow kind of an infinite amount of energy to do it all at once. So the way that we expect this to happen is you nucleate these bubbles of true vacuum within the kind of ambient false vacuum, and then these then want to expand and liberate more and more energy, and so eventually you fill up your volume and you percolate with this kind of phase transition. So it's quite a simple picture to think about. But in terms of a problem to actually go away and do calculations, it's incredibly difficult. There have been many brilliant theoretical physicists who've been thinking about this for a long time, but there's still a lot that we would like to understand better. So movie time. I'm just going to show you, just to give you a kind of picture of the kinds of processes we're interested in. So we've got the blue false vacuum kind of fizzing with all these little quantum fluctuations, and you can see the bubbles nucleating and colliding with each other, until you end up with basically just true vacuum left over. This is the kind of thing that we want to understand in more detail. So why am I interested in this setup? It's a general process which can be applied in many different settings in cosmology. I'm just going to highlight three of the main ones here. So false vacuum decay plays an important role in many models of inflation, and particularly in kind of eternal inflation models and multiverse scenarios. That could have interesting observational consequences if it gave rise, if you had these different little baby universe bubbles that expand and collide with each other, you could expect to see interesting observational imprints on the cosmic microwave background, for example. We think that the Higgs may possibly be in a false vacuum state, in a metastable state. And so then understanding this process of vacuum decay really becomes an existential question. Are we going to get annihilated at any second by a bubble wall coming along and destroying us? Hopefully not, but it'd be good to know. But really the application that's kind of closest to my heart and my other research interests is in gravitational wave cosmology. So if you can nucleate these bubbles and the bubbles expand and collide with each other, it turns out this is an incredibly efficient way of generating very loud gravitational wave signals in the early universe. And so these phase transitions are one of the key kind of observational targets of future gravitational wave missions such as LISA. So it'd be fantastic to understand the physics of these transitions in more detail. Okay, so we know in quantum mechanics how tunneling processes work. We know that you can use WKB methods and things like that to derive a rate at which you expect particles to tunnel through some kind of potential barrier. And the expression that you end up with looks like basically you have this is a semi-classical approximation, so I'm ignoring. Can I point with this? Oh yeah. So we're ignoring kind of higher order terms in H bar, but it's governed by this coefficient that appears in an exponential, which looks like the action of a particle, but in Euclidean time. Okay, so we call this the Euclidean action. And the kind of main techniques that people have been using for a long time now, since the work of Sidney Coleman back in the 1970s, basically take this approach from quantum mechanics, so for individual particles, and then kind of by analogy extend this to fields. So you write down your decay rate per unit volume, and you have this Euclidean action for the entire field, which goes in the exponential there. So obviously you have to make some kinds of approximations to proceed with this, because you've gone from having a single particle to having a field with infinitely many degrees of freedom. So it's a much, much more difficult problem. Usually the way this is done with these instanton methods is by making symmetry reductions. So you assume a particular form of symmetry on the bubble that nucleates, and this allows you to make some headway. But, you know, we would like to go beyond the kinds of questions that you can ask and answer with these instanton methods. So in particular, what does this bubble nucleation process look like in real time? You know, sometimes it's very difficult to visualize or to interpret these Euclidean time results in real time. And this is particularly relevant in the context of cosmology, where we know that you have time-dependent things going on. You have a dynamical background space-time. So eventually we'd like to move towards some kind of real-time understanding of this vacuum decay process. There's also the fact that by assuming a symmetry, you're kind of focusing just on a single bubble. But if I imagine, you know, I see the false vacuum boiling and generating these bubbles, could I expect these bubbles to cluster together? Could that encode some kind of interesting cosmological information? And if so, that could have lots of interesting imprints on the kinds of observational questions I was talking about before. So this here is a figure from a really nice paper that was led by Dalila, who's here in the audience, showing that with the lattice simulations, which I'm going to describe later on in this talk, it looks like indeed bubbles do tend to cluster together. So I think this is really nice because this is a clear result which would have been, you know, it's very hard to see how you could find that using these instanton methods that are kind of the go-to and have been for a long time. So that's the motivation for trying to develop some kind of real-time understanding of this process of vacuum decay. And there's two ways that we can go forwards with this. There's using these quantum analog experiments. So if I can watch the vacuum decay happening in the lab, then I can learn something about what this looks like. But then also there are these lattice simulations, and I've already shown you some results from that. This is another semi-classical approach. So it's also at the same kind of semi-classical level as the instanton calculations, but you come at it in a very different way. And there's a lot of really interesting open questions about you know, the synergies and the differences between the lattice simulations and the instantons. And ultimately, you know, we want to use all of these three things together to generate some kind of deeper understanding of this process. Okay, so that's the motivation. So I'm going to start by talking about the first of those two points I had on that slide there, which is the analog experiments. And then I'll come back in the kind of final section of the talk to talk about the lattice simulations. So the experimental platform that we're proposing to use here is atomic Bose-Einstein condensates, right? So we have cold atomic Bose gases. These are really fascinating systems, which as someone who comes from a cosmology background and not a kind of quantum technologies background, I've been learning a lot about these things in the past year or so. So these are, we can exert a really amazing amount of experimental control over these things, but we can also directly, you know, image collective quantum behavior of these systems in the laboratory, which is amazing. So there's four words there in the title of that slide. Oh, where's my pointer gone? So I'm going to break down why each of those four things is important. So why bosonic? Well, we want our atoms, you know, if your atoms have made out of an even number of fermions, then on scales larger than the size of the atom, they look like just a single boson. And that means if you cool them enough, they can undergo Bose-Einstein condensation. So they collapse into a state where they're all in the kind of grand state of the system, and they become this kind of diffuse atomic field. So this is how we go from, rather than having like kind of point-like atoms, we have this kind of field-like thing that can simulate a relativistic field. Why do we need them to be cold? Well, we want them to condense, and we also want to kind of probe the quantum excitations of this system rather than thermal excitations. And so we kind of, just on kind of dimensional analysis grounds, you expect that to happen when KT is less than H bar omega, where omega is the kind of energies of the excitations you're interested in. This would be in like the dispersion relation of the normal modes of the system, the omega that you get from that. Just
that's usually not huge. Usually very far away from that.
Okay, interesting. I'll get on to, maybe we can have this discussion about, I have a slide later about experimental parameters. So why build this thing out of atoms? Well, there are these amazing experimental techniques that allow us to cool and trap the atoms very precisely, and to control the strength of their interactions can be tuned by applying external magnetic fields. And so we can really engineer exactly what this condensate is going to be doing. And then finally, the fact that it's a gas, you have very low density, and that means that the cloud is kind of large enough to be imaged with quite good resolution. Okay. So we can describe what we expect this condensate to be doing. We have this kind of quantum field, the kind of wave function for this ensemble of atoms. And you can think about this as being a very highly occupied, kind of almost classical looking piece, which is the wave function condensate, plus some little quantum fluctuations on top of that. This is this kind of mean field description that's often used. the condensate wave function obeys this equation here, which is called the Gross-Pitiyevsky equation. And so usually there's some kind of trapping potential in here. I'm going to ignore this term for now, and this is something that we're thinking about and want to dig into a bit more in future work. But the reason that I want to throw this away is that as soon as you have this thing which breaks translation invariance, all of a sudden it doesn't look very relativistic anymore. So we need to, The idea would be to create some kind of box trap, which on the inside of the trap, it looks as homogeneous as possible, and then you get some kind of deviation from that as you get very close to the edges. And that's why it's one of the great things about working with the particular experimental group we're working with in Cambridge, because they're really experts in building these box traps, which can create as homogeneous a field as possible on the inside. Okay, so if I throw away that term, I have something which basically looks like the Schrodinger equation, but I'm adding in this nonlinear interaction term here with the strength G. Okay, so this is why this is often called the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. And this is very clearly a non-relativistic field theory that I've written down here. And it has a potential which doesn't have any kind of false vacuum in it. So how do I go from this to something which looks like the setup that I had on my first slide? I'm gonna try in the next couple of slides to motivate where that comes from. The first kind of hint that you might get something looking like relativistic behavior comes from if you look at the dispersion relation of excitations of that system described by the Gross-Pitiyevsky equation. And you see these two clear regimes which emerge. So there's this kind of fundamental length scale called the healing length, which I've written here as letter xi. If you go to scales smaller than that, which is over on the right here, you get this quadratic dispersion relationship emerging, which is very typical of non-relativistic systems. But if you look on scales larger than that, so smaller wave numbers, I get a linear dispersion relationship, which is exactly what you expect for a relativistic wave equation. A Okay, so this is the first kind of hint that we could get some kind of relativistic analog coming out of this, if we can focus on the dynamics on these large scales. I still need to give this relativistic field a potential. Whoops, let's go back to the previous one. So how do I give this field a potential rather than it just being this massless scalar field? The way that we can do that is by coupling two different BECs together. And so practically, experimentally, these could be two different hyperfine states of the same atomic species. If you couple them together and they talk to each other, that can generate effectively, if you're looking at the relative modes, so the difference between the two BECs, that generates something that looks like this, which is a cosine potential, which is exactly the same as you can think of this like a classical pendulum, which also has a cosine potential. So if I start here in the middle of this plot, that's like having the pendulum standing up like this, and so obviously it's unstable, it just wants to immediately decay. In terms of the BEC, the pendulum hanging up like this is like the two different species being in antiphase with each other. So they want to be in phase with each other because they can talk to each other, so that's why it wants to decay down into this true vacuum here. So obviously, having an unstable state like that isn't going to give us any kind of bubble nucleation. We want to have a metastable state, so we want to have some kind of barrier that the field has to tunnel through. The way you can do that is by taking the coupling between the two species and very rapidly modulating it. So this is a little tricky to think about, but going back to the pendulum analogy, and the mathematics works out exactly the same, it's like having a pendulum where you take the pivot point and you drive that, you oscillate it very rapidly. And you can see in this movie here, this is someone actually doing this in the lab, if you rapidly oscillate a pendulum, it makes that upward state metastable. So you can see him prodding it, and it can survive in that state for quite a while. So this is exactly the same kind of mathematics behind what happens with the BEC when you modulate this coupling between the two species. You can create this metastable state. So this is the idea. So okay, let's look at this system and go back to these plots of the dispersion relation. So first of all, if I look at the case where there's no modulation of the coupling, it's just a constant coupling between the two species, and I start in the case where they're in antiphase and kind of look at little fluctuations around that, you can see clearly that it's unstable. I get this kind of tachyonic looking dispersion relationship, so immediately it will want to decay. And now if I switch on the modulated coupling, now finally I get to something which looks like the Klein-Gordon theory living in a false vacuum state in the potential, which is exactly what I want to simulate. And so the fact that this in this large scales, that the blue and the red lines agree with each other is fantastic. That's exactly what we want to see, to have an analog of this vacuum decay process.
That's a way.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at flow K systems, and there's a lot of literature in the last few years out there, in the moment we have interaction, the equilibrium temperature is different. So the system blows up.
Sorry, so
it starts to heat up very, very quickly if you have interaction in this. If you're capable of doing that, it's only that you have no interaction. So you have no particle force.
Okay. I think maybe we should discuss about this in the
experiment.
Okay.
We have tried that about 7 years ago.
Okay.
It blows up into the face.
Okay. I think, yeah, we should discuss this during the lunch break for sure.
I will edit in my talk now.
Okay. Okay.
I see
you again. Okay. Okay. So bearing with me for now. Yeah, if we trust this result for the dispersion relationship, we find something which looks exactly like what we want for a Klein-Gordon field in a false vacuum state, which is what we want. So that's kind of motivating how these experiments can simulate this relativistic vacuum decay process. I'm now going to talk a bit about the work that we've been doing to understand how to bridge that gap between experiments and cosmology. So first of all, I want to have a brief digression. Before I talk about the lattice simulations, I want to talk a bit about how we're choosing the parameters of the system that we want to simulate. And a big kind of goal of what we want to do is to see something close to the kind of zero temperature dynamics of bubble nucleation. So obviously any realistic experiment will not be at zero temperature, But what we want to do is kind of take this typical temperature scale for the system and try and make this as large as possible so that it's easier to get the actual temperature below this, right? So this is has been kind of our main goal in kind of scanning over the possible parameter space. And then once this temperature is fixed, we can then scan over a range of different decay rates while keeping this scale the same. We've found a way of doing this by basically if you change the number of atoms in the trap and simultaneously change the strength with which they're trapped into this 1D setup, you can keep this Gn, this kind of typical energy scale of the system, fixed, but then you can change the key parameter here is the dimensionless number density of the atoms. By changing that, you can directly control the rate at which the system decays, which is great because if you want to compare with predictions, for example, from the instanton approach, it's very difficult to calibrate that exactly at one point in parameter space. So really what we want to do is see how this thing evolves as I change the parameters of the system. And I'll come back and show you some results from that from the lattice simulations in a minute. In terms of language, which is hopefully helpful for experimentalists in the audience, this is some more kind of experimental details about what we want to do. So the isotope that we're proposing to use is potassium-41. There are these two spin states we want to use, which you can see that I can tune a particular Feshbach resonance close to this value of the external magnetic field. And what happens is that the nonlinear interaction between the two species passes through zero there, whereas the nonlinear self-interaction of each of the two is very close to being equal. And so that setup is exactly what you want in order to have the cleanest possible mapping onto the relativistic theory. So it's great that nature has provided us this particular Feshbach resonance where that's possible. There's a 1D box trap, which is kind of shown here in this image from Zoran and his group in Cambridge, where basically you tightly confine the atoms along two directions, and you have a kind of long, effective 1D system. And again, you want to have that as close to homogeneous as possible. So you really want to clamp it down close to the edges and then in between let it be as flat as possible. And then as I said before, we vary the number of atoms and we vary the strength of the trapping in those two transverse directions in such a way you keep the energy scale fixed, but you can scan over decay rates. Okay, so now, in the course of developing the experiment, we all, of course, want to have some kind of expectations of what we might see, and we will need to have some way of interpreting the results of the experiment when it's actually run. And so a really useful tool for doing this is these semi-classical lattice simulations I mentioned before. So the idea here is kind of, you can almost think of it as the opposite of what is done in the instanton approach, where you start, in the instanton approach, you start with, you can kind of think of it as a classical initial state. I'm ignoring all of the quantum fluctuations in the system and just saying the field is just homogeneous. And then it takes a very non-classical path in imaginary time, and I end up with a bubble. In the lattice simulations, instead, I try to represent the quantumness in the initial state by sampling some kind of quantum noise, putting some fluctuations around that homogeneous value for the field. But then if I'm doing this on a classical computer, I only know how to do classical time evolution. So that's what I do. I take this initial state, and I evolve it forwards classically in real time to end up with a bubble as well. So again, there's some really interesting open questions about these two very different semi-classical approaches and ways in which they might agree or ways in which they might differ. But regardless of that, they're an incredibly useful tool for understanding how we can develop and interpret these experiments. I just want to stress that the aim is not to replace the experiments. So always, ultimately, our eyes are set on these experiments, which will really capture the full kind of quantum dynamics of the system. Okay, so I'm going to show you some output of these simulations. So these are from 1D simulations. So time is starting from zero at the bottom and is increasing as you move up these plots, and then space is on the horizontal axis. And here I should say we're simulating not just the effective relativistic theory, we're simulating the full kind of gross Pitievsky system with the time oscillating coupling between the two species. So the fact that on the right-hand side here, I see this nice bubble nucleation event happening is a really nice kind of confirmation that the system behaves the way that we would like it to. On the left-hand side, this is just to show you if I initialize the system without that modulation, so without the little bump in the potential, then it just immediately decays and you see something which looks nothing like a bubble nucleation event. And now this is the same thing happening in two dimensions. So just to show you can see some nice bubbles forming and expanding. There's an interesting thing here where the two different bubbles are in inequivalent true vacua, right? So there is the main wall between them. And then we can see when these bubble walls collide with each other, you get these little oscillating features, oscillons. So you can see there's some really interesting kind of real-time dynamics there. Okay, so a really important input for these simulations is the initial conditions, right? We said with this lattice approach, we're putting all of the quantum stuff into the initial conditions. And so the decay rates, for example, that you'll extract from these simulations is very, very highly correlated with what initial states you put in, what ensemble of random fluctuations you're drawing from. So we need to make sure that we're getting that right if we want to have any faith in the decay rates that we're extracting. So a lot of the simulations that have been done have been using a simple choice of just putting in white noise, so it's equal fluctuation power on all scales. But what we've been doing over the past kind of year is figuring out what is exactly the right state to inject into the simulations to capture really what is the vacuum state of this system. And what we find is that the power spectrum of fluctuations, again, on large scales where we trust the relativistic analogy, it agrees exactly with what we expect from the Klein-Gordon theory. So this is a really nice confirmation that this analog system does replicate the effective relativistic theory at the level of the quantum fluctuations and not just in terms of the classical evolution. If you go to small scales, so scales smaller than the Heeling length, we do see a deviation, which is to be expected because that's where the non-relativistic behavior was kicking in before. And this manifests itself as a sort of excess fluctuation power compared to the relativistic theory, which again, you can interpret that as being like the white noise that people have been using previously. Okay, so now we have taken those vacuum initial conditions and run a large ensemble of simulations. So and as I described before, we're scanning over the parameter space to see how the rate of decay of the system changes as you change the parameters. And the key behavior that we're looking for is exponential decay. This is what we expect. So if I look at the survival probability, right, I can go over time and count how many of my individual realizations of the simulation has still survived, so not nucleated the bubble yet as a function of time. That should reach a regime where it scales exponentially. So on this log plot, it should look like a straight line. And you can see that there is some very nice agreement with that here, and that the slope of this line tells us about the decay rate. So if I take all the slopes of those lines and I plot those, you can see that I get, again, with the log axis here, I get very good agreement with just a straight line, which is exactly what you would expect theoretically. So this is a really nice confirmation that we think we really are seeing something that agrees with our expectations for this relativistic decay process. Another interesting thing is if I do the exact same thing but use the white noise initial conditions rather than the vacuum initial conditions that we've found, you find that the system actually decays faster. Even though if I go back to this plot, you can see the white noise, the amplitude of the fluctuations I'm putting in is much smaller on large scales. But despite that, the system still decays faster, and I think this is a really nice demonstration that the putting in white noise, you're putting the system into an excited state. It's not in the correct vacuum state. And so this really highlights that thinking carefully about these things is really important for getting reliable results from the lattice simulations. Okay, so now just a word about doing this at finite temperature. So as I said before, the real experiment will inevitably be at a non-zero temperature, and the kind of simple operational question you can ask is, how high can I allow the temperature to be before I see the decay rate start to change? So again, we've been doing this here, and you can see that as I dial up the temperature so the most blue line is at zero temperature, and then as I start dialing the temperature up, these curves get hotter. And you can see that for a long time, these straight lines that I fit are parallel to each other, which is telling you that the decay rate doesn't change until I reach sort of this red curve here. So this is really nice because it tells us that for our particular choice of experimental parameters, you only need to cool the BEC down to temperatures of below about 18 nanokelvin, which is well within reach of the experimental setups that exist today. Okay, so just before I wrap up, I don't know how much time I've got, actually. But before I wrap up, I just wanted to say a few words about kind of some open problems that we still want to think about. So one is something that I mentioned earlier on, which was boundary effects, right? All of the simulations we've been running are assuming a periodic field, but obviously the actual experiment will be in a box trap and the field will have edges to it. And there's some interesting questions you can ask about, you know, the fact that you have an edge, does that, the edge of the BEC act as like a nucleation site where you preferentially nucleate bubbles? Or does it mean that you actually have kind of a loss of effective volume, you have fewer bubbles there? And I think really to answer that question, we need to figure out you know, in detail, what is the spectrum of initial fluctuations that corresponds to that non-homogeneous initial state? And that's a very difficult problem because then you can't just work with Fourier modes anymore when it's not periodic. So this is something that we're starting to think about now. There's also the question of renormalization. This is something that Silke mentioned in her talk this morning. The idea that if you have fluctuations in the system, this can back react onto the mean field and change the mean field dynamics. And really, we need to understand this quite well if we're going to do a mapping from the experiment onto a particular relativistic theory, because it will change, you know, you will renormalize the bare parameters of the relativistic theory due to the presence of these fluctuations. So that's something that we want to understand in more detail as well. I'm showing here on the right-hand side a plot from a really nice paper that was led by Jonathan, which was looking at, so just for the pure Klein-Gordon theory, so not thinking about an analog, even just in the pure Klein-Gordon theory, as you put in the fluctuations, this will renormalize your bare lattice parameters and change effectively what the potential is that the field is living in. Okay, and then finally, there's this issue with parametric resonance. So the fact that we're modulating the coupling between the two species, again, in work that was led by Jonathan, it was shown that this can actually cause instabilities on small scales. The expectation, you know, whenever we talk to our experimental colleagues, they always say, oh, well, if you just push that to small enough scales, you don't have to worry about it. But it would be really nice to understand exactly how that instability would be quenched in the experiment, if indeed it is. So yeah, that's another thing that's worth thinking about in the future. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up there. So I have talked about this process of vacuum decay, why it's really fascinating for cosmologists, and it can play many different roles in the early universe. But despite that, it's still, you know, there's still a lot of open questions we'd like to understand. In particular, we would love to understand in real time how this process happens. And yeah, so there are these amazing quantum technologies that will allow us to actually see this process happening in the lab, which is incredibly exciting. And I've told you a bit about some of the work that we've been doing using these lattice simulations to try to understand how to make that link. So yeah, thank you very much for listening. Yeah, let me just find that again quickly. This one, yeah.
So I see the zero has large errors. Is that an issue?
That is an issue. That's a good question. So that is something that we will have to think carefully about, because you would want to, if you really want to have this be at this zero crossing, you need to have quite good magnetic field stability. And this is something we've been discussing with Zoran and his group in Cambridge. It may be that for an initial experiment, you may want to use instead a different setup with potassium 39, where there's a more stable zero crossing, but then the blue and green lines are a bit more different from each other, which isn't ideal, but you can still get a good relativistic analogy there. So I guess this all depends on the level of magnetic field stability that would be possible in the experiment, but there are backup options. It's not like this is the only system that could give you.
And the upper one is great, but that yeah. Upper one should be quite a thick red line, should it not based on the errors?
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that would be the issue with this setup. With potassium 39, that issue would be better, but the blue and green lines would be more different.
Questions over here, please. I'm just wondering, the simulation that you showed with the bug
Yeah. I'm not sure about vortices. I'd need to think about that. But yes, so this is a topological thing because basically what's happening here is I'm starting in this false vacuum and one bubble is dropping down into here and the other bubble is dropping down into here. So you get this kind of topological domain wall between the two true vacua. In terms of vortices, let's talk afterwards in the lunch break. I need to think about that.
Okay. Wait a minute.
Okay.
Sorry, that's actually not working.
I will show you how this topological thing.
Next question, back here.
Yeah, thanks, Alex. I just wondered if I could ask about the renormalization. So
yeah,
I think it's
absolutely.
On your slide 22. You have the graph of the spectrum of the fluctuations.
Yes.
Yeah. So I guess in your sort of truncated Wigner approach, you have to put some sort of a cutoff in.
Yeah.
So I just wonder how you choose.
Yeah, exactly. So for this kind of initial work, we've just fixed the UV cutoff, but absolutely you would want to vary that and see how the decay rate would flow as you change the UV cutoff. I think Jonathan has done some investigations of this as well in the pure Klein-Gordon setting. And it does look like as you vary that can be absorbed into a renormalization of the parameters.
Okay, I guess I just wondered, like, on that graph, roughly where do you actually choose it at the moment?
I think we're about, let me see, so the actual, I think we're about here. So definitely, that's moving around more than I want. Is that about psi times k equal to 4 or so?
Okay.
So you're definitely in the regime where you can already start seeing the non-relativisticness of the system in that on those scales. Yeah.
Great. Thank you.
Very nice.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So we're very much in the regime where the decays happen quite quickly. So this is something that gives confidence that if you do a truncated Wigner thing, that you can get something reasonable. I mean, you do still see that if you dial up the barrier parameter, so you make the timescale for decay longer, you do still see bubbles nucleating, and you do still see something that looks consistent with the picture I was drawing. There is this question about how long can you evolve for before you stop trusting the truncated Wigner approximation? And not off the top of my head, no. Yeah. But yeah, I want to stress we're in the regime where the decays happen pretty quickly, so that you would, that was. Well, compared to the natural timescale of the system. So yeah, everything I'm showing is within a single light crossing time, for example, of the field.
I've just one thing is that wouldn't you expect that the spectrum is not white but it's thermal of these excitations?
Isn't white, but sorry. So yeah, this plot is in the zero temperature case. So what we're showing.
Yeah. Okay. So these are the vacuum fluctuations. They're
yes.
white.
Yes.
Yeah,
yeah.
But
yeah,
in the
exactly.
experiment, they would be thermal.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yes.
And we will. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. So and of course you always have thermal fluctuation because it costs infinite time. The second law prevents you to get to zero temperature.
No, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah. So you will always have thermal.
What this result is showing is on a conceptual level,
yeah.
right, the vacuum fluctuations are the same on large scales in this system as they are in the
yes.
in the relativistic case.
Okay.
And then, yeah, obviously, yeah, when you turn on the temperature, you'll get thermal fluctuations. But again, the IR regime of this plot at finite temperature looks like what you would also expect for a Klein-Gordon field, which is nice.
The other questions? No. Yeah, but I would. Yeah, no. The second part is that if you look at this, your excitations in the trapped part, wouldn't you expect that it's more a Klein-Gordon dynamic than a Sein-Gordon dynamic? Of course, I mean, as a Sein-Gordon dynamic, so the Klein. Of course, the Klein-Gordon dynamic is much easier because it's non-interacting in Gaussian. But I would expect that the field dynamics in that state if you have a large enough tunneling rate, is a Sine-Gordon dynamics, which is a very strongly correlated quantum field.
Yeah, so we're making an assumption here that you can initialize your state very, like, as small fluctuations in the false vacuum where it will look like they're just Gaussian, and then you let them evolve nonlinearly, and then eventually you get bubble forming. But yeah, taking into account higher order corrections of as you start to go away from that and feel the turnover of the potential, that would be something that would definitely be interesting to calculate.
And this 18 nanokelvin depends on this, on parameters of the scattering length and all that stuff.
Exactly. So these things here, T bar is like a dimensionless number. So this result is true regardless of the parameters of the system. But then if I translate that to our particular parameters, it gets 18 nanokelvin. Yeah.
Okay, well, let's thank our speaker again.
Thank you.